Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. And the other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, I want to mention our monthly guidebook slash workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your musical life and career on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from My Music Masterclass, so if you want to learn more, go to mymusicmasterclass.com, hit subscribe in the header, and you'll be good to go. All right, everyone, we are here today with Walt Weisskopf, who is an amazing woodwind player, mainly tenor saxophone, as we know him. Great composer, educator, has written a ton of books, done several videos for My Music Masterclass, and we are super psyched to have you, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Adam. Thanks so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
You're healthy? Your family's good?
Yes. Yeah, I would... I can't feel luckier than I feel. I'm just, waiting like we all are for this to go away.
The virus and the other
virus. Yeah, right. Well, that too. Yeah, that one's dependent on the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. January 20th like can't come soon enough.
Some people have just gone straight up crazy with all this stuff. I think Golding started...
40% of the country seems to be straight up crazy.
He started soundtracking stuff he was watching on TV. This live soundtrack. Oh, no,
Golding's live Golding live stream scored. He did a live stream score to the election results.
That's hysterical. Yeah.
I start worrying about you guys though. You guys have, you know, you've all been road dogs for so long. And
of course, with the
that's true.
With the election results, you have to... you know, leave an open-ended harmony, right? You can't resolve it at the end. No. And a matter of fact, you had to play it for what? I mean, you're still going, actually. You're still going. There's still a suspended... Yeah,
we need a new name for that type of cadence.
There's still a dominant chord with tensions waiting to resolve. It is not yet resolved.
I'm waiting for the Henry Hay version of the Trump rant.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of rants... I know that you started your career with Buddy Rich, right?
I did, 1981.
Were you around for the famous Buddy Rich rant?
Yes, I was actually on the bus.
That's amazing, man. You must have been like, what, 21, 22 years old at that point?
I guess I started when I was 21. At the time of the rant, I believe I was probably 22.
Right.
I'm not familiar with any of this.
Oh, you're not? No. Well, you're going to have to catch up.
Exactly. I might have to privately look that up. I
don't know. It's important history.
I'm sure that this is not the first time you've been asked this question, so I won't ask too much about it. It's probably been one of those things, especially at one point when it was very popular. Now it's lost its steam a little bit, but I just thought of it today. I'm like, man, that was amazing, but that must have been... I'm sure there's a totally other side to Buddy and playing with him and everything like that, but I'm sure that wasn't the first rant, of course, too. He was probably just a very, very serious cat, or am I wrong?
No. I think that you're exactly right, because you're a musician and you're intuitive, and the experience was, for me, I mean, I'm not at all making this a real analogy, but it was kind of like my version of, you know, basic training or being in the army as a youngster. We were all young. I remember hanging out with guys who at that time were 25 and I thought they were old.
Right. Right. And it was a young band.
It was a young band for the most part. Of course, there were a couple exceptions, but for the most part, we were all young. And the rant thing, it was just like Buddy's ritual. As a matter of fact, I remember I would be snickering behind my seat, you know, behind the seat back. You know, I was so excited. Like, here's the rant. And that was, it would happen like maybe once or, you know, once a week or once every couple of weeks. And Buddy was just, he was a very tragic figure in so many ways, because he really never had a childhood. He never had a chance to be socialized. And he did the best he could. You've, I don't know how many of those Carson appearances you've seen him on, but believe it or not, I'm old enough to have seen him live on the Carson show.
Right.
And he was he could be personable, but he was very lonely and a very tragic figure. And all he really had was the music and the band. And when he felt that, all of us who are band leaders, you can feel when the sidemen are not serious. And when he felt that, and it may not have been really warranted, but if he felt it, that people were, you know, maybe giggling or having fun or rolling their eyes, he would get really offended and really angry. And that's what would set him off. So it wasn't really about anything other than, it wasn't personal. I never took it personally. I mean, I had my moments with Buddy. But really, I kept a low profile. I was lucky. I mean, physically, I was far away from him in the band. I mean, the only way I could have been further away would be if I had the baritone saxophone chair. But in the tenor chair that I was in, I was a pretty safe distance. Right. And he more or less left me alone. But he was very invested in what he was doing. And I learned a lot about being professional from Buddy, because he never, ever had any excuses. He could be sick, he could be cranky, whatever it was, he never gave less than 100%. It was just so instructive to me.
So he expected all that for himself as well.
He held himself to the highest standard. I mean,
yeah,
I was 21, 22 years old. You got to keep in mind that this guy played with Charlie Parker. He played with everybody.
Yeah.
And I think probably in a certain way, even though it was his band, he's probably thinking to himself, I'm playing with a bunch of amateurs. I'm playing with a bunch of children here. I'm trying to put on a show. I played with Tommy Dorsey, Frank Sinatra, you name it. And now I'm playing with a bunch of college kids who were spoiled brats in most cases. And when you look at it from that perspective, it does give you a lot more room for some empathy. But for the most part, we didn't take it personally. It was just him. It was just him. And I mean, I feel a little bit conflicted about the whole rant thing. That kind of thing, I feel, should have stayed inside the bus. But, you know, obviously, it didn't. It didn't happen that way. And
I mean, that's complicated, man, especially when you know someone feels an art form to that extent. You know,
I agree.
It hurts them, like, physically, like, to have to get that upset. You know what I mean?
So absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, as a leader, I felt that myself. And when I was younger, I used to lash out a little bit. And then, you know, you get older and more mature, you realize that just doesn't work. It just does not motivate anybody to get angry. And Buddy just, that was the only thing he had. He couldn't really, didn't have a lot of tools in the toolbox other than that.
Actually, like, on that note, like, Adam, last podcast we did, just Adam and I, we talked about how musicians sometimes they get so wrapped up in their careers and their music that they never take vacations, they never take breaks. That's kind of like along those lines. Like, you have to have something other than music,
or
other than
completely
your, like, art form. Did it take you, did you ever have that problem? Did you ever not have, like, a life outside of your music?
I think a little bit, but I have always maybe recognized that. I think at certain times, just depending on my living situation, like, I remember when I was living in Brooklyn, when I first lived in Brooklyn in the early 80s, I lived right across from Fort Greene Park, and I would go running every day, which was terrific. And then I ended up in a different home where there was just, it wasn't conducive to that.
Yep.
And I remember I was so desperate to go run. I had returned actually from the Buddy Rich tour in Japan. Was that? Maybe it was Toshiko Akiyoshi, but I got back and I was all jet lagged. And I was up at 5 a.m. and I said, I'm going running. I don't care what it takes. And I went to this, like a ball field and ran around in the dark. And I realized, you know, I could fall and break my ankle and nobody would ever find me until, you know, 7 a.m. So in more recently, now I play tennis almost every day and I know how good it is for me.
Yep.
And it doesn't take up all day and I still have time to do what I want to do as far as I kind of have to make myself practice because right now there's not that much to practice for, but
yep.
I still am managing to basically practice for an hour a day. But I agree that other activities, it's very, very important. You got to listen. If you can't maintain your mental health, you're not going to have that much else. There's just not enough. Nobody has that capacity. So you got to have other stuff to do.
Especially today's world. I mean, people put up with less and less from other people because everyone's become so independent.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different world. I mean.
And getting back to kind of what you were saying about Buddy Rich and, you know, how he grew up and how serious he was. I mean, you can kind of tell that the gig was everything to him. And it has a lot to do with what you have outside of music. A lot of people have a family life or this or that, and music is a part of the whole. But for some people, music is everything, right? And so for a guy like Buddy, it was maybe life or death in his mind if a gig didn't go over well, right?
I think that it was, when I reflect on that, it's interesting. I knew at the time, I said to myself, in so many ways, this is the best job I'm ever going to have. I'm never going to have this again because I felt like I was, number one, so lucky to make it through the first few days, the first few gigs, because I was really not equipped. I was not prepared, but I did prepare and I did know how to take advice to some extent. And I hung in, but watching Buddy and then learning a little bit about, of course, he was married for a long time. He had a daughter, Kathy. So he did have a family, but it wasn't a conventional family, of course, because he's on the road all the time.
Right.
And, you know, those of us obviously who were road rats in later life, you can relate to it, but I don't know how much, you know, I worked with Frank Sinatra for years also, and I've watched documentaries about Sinatra and read a couple of books, and fathers who are not there, it's almost impossible to raise a child, and I'm very thankful that I was able to be there when my son was young, but if you're not, I mean, there's just no substitute for that. I mean, you can be traveling and you can be busy, but still have time for that. But I don't think that, number one, Buddy Rich had no role model for that, and he didn't know how to do it. Even if he had been, he was probably scared of it in a way. So he had this family, but it was almost like it was a name only. And we actually went to his house one time in Palm Desert, and It was a little weird. You know, you could tell that there was not like a whole lot of conventional family love kind of thing going on. It was almost like it was for show.
Right.
But, I know his daughter. I know Kathy. I know she loved him. His wife, I don't know. Who knows? But I think that it must have been, number one, impossible to be married to someone like Buddy Rich. He just had no idea how to do anything like that. Marriage is a challenge,
yeah.
Even in the, you know, good circumstances. I mean, it's just
it's definitely a give and take. I mean, it's
a work in progress.
Yeah,
but he had no clue, and the only thing he really had was, I have to go. I have to make a living, and he would go. And like you say, the only thing really that was a barometer for him was the gig and how the gig went. And it didn't matter if it was a high school auditorium, we played a lot of those, or if it was playing literally backing up Frank Sinatra in the Dominican Republic, which we also did, or at Carnegie Hall. I mean, he never gave less than 110%.
Which is so cool. In that area, there's definitely something to be, you know, passed down to generations who might take a day off or half-ass it if they don't feel their best. I mean, but moving on to Sinatra, like, how was your experience with Sinatra, and how much did you gain from that experience? I mean, obviously, he's got to be one of your heroes, and he's one of mine and many people.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I reflect on it, that's when I said to myself, this is the best job I'm ever going to have. I mean, playing with Frank Sinatra every day, every night, for nights in a row. I was in the kind of like the New York East Coast band. At that time, he had a band in Vegas. He had a band in L.A. and even in Florida. But we did a lot of work over the course of 4 years. The last 4 years that he worked, I was...
Were there like specific arrangers for like different, like, did you ever work with arrangers, or was that stuff already done?
It was done, right? It's a good question, but yes, it was basically all the classic charts. So at that point, it was not really a work in progress. Those arrangements were hits and they were played. All the, Billy May, Don Costa, Nelson Riddle, those were kind of I shouldn't say that. There were certain charts that were kind of refurbished that maybe hadn't, that they were lost. And there was a terrific musician named Bill Rogers, who was a Vegas trombone player, arranger, and he would transcribe arrangements that were non-existent. And few of those we played. Frank Jr. Cool. was particularly instrumental. Frank Jr. was a terrific guy. He's really, in a way, he's not appreciated. Died tragically at 70 years old, very young. But he was another tragic figure in the jazz world. But he was terrifically talented.
Yeah,
and totally. he was the one who for the last several years of Sinatra's career, he was the one who would bring out the arrangements that hadn't been played in a long time. When there was a kind of an obscure tune that he loved, if he couldn't find it, he would have Bill Rogers transcribe it and bring it in, and we would play it. But most of the bulk of it, 90%, was the charts that had been in the book for 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah. Was that just like enjoyable for you? Like the blending, all those harmonies, I mean, all that, just, do you miss that kind of like,
you mean, know, the big section band playing thing?
I do. I do, definitely. And that was, when I played with Sinatra, I was already kind of grown and matured, and I was raised in big bands. All that experience really I was able to bring to bear. And we had a ball. At that time, the section was, Mike Smith, my old buddy from the Buddy Rich Band, was the one who put that section together. It was Jim Snidero, myself, Dave Brandom, and later on it changed a little bit, but we all had a history, those guys, for North Texas guys together, and of course I knew Mike from Buddy's band, so we were all kind of on the same page, and it was very minimal jazz playing, but just to play in a section and play those arrangements, it was so much fun. I knew at that time, I said, I'm never going to forget this. I still remember it so fondly. It was so much fun. It was just a blast.
How involved at that point in Frank's career was he with the band in sound checks and rehearsing or any of that stuff? Was it basically just a musical director and Frank would come on, or was he still very interactive with the band?
I think that, what you said first, he was not, he didn't have much to do with us. Most times, probably most of the time, we rehearsed and soundchecked without him.
Right.
And at, 8:05, he would come on and do the show. So I might have interacted with Frank maybe like once or twice. Mm-hmm. One time I had this like, one of my favorite arrangements on earth was this, I think it was a Billy May arrangement of Street of Dreams. And it was I mean, you can pull it up. It's unbelievable. There's like a 4-bar tenor solo. And I just laid for that every night. And of course, I wasn't made as constrained as I might have been if I did the job now in my career. So at one point after I played, he looked back and he said, "I don't know what the hell he's doing, but I like it." And to me, that was like the highest compliment.
That's awesome.
He really did love jazz, and he knew in a lot of ways he really didn't know about it, but he really was a student of music, and he had so much in the bank, so much experience. But by the time I was working with him, by the time we were in the band, he would rehearse with us maybe, you know, every 10th time, something like right. that. Most times we'd just see him on the gig.
But much like Buddy Rich, I mean, I don't think Frank would go out there giving less than 200%, right? I mean, he was...
Certainly not. Yeah. I mean, it was, for him, it was a little bit different because he had reinvented himself so many different times. When you understand his career a little bit, as I've come to, by the time I worked with him, his voice was more or less shot. Mm-hmm. But that to me was even more instructive because I began to understand that the actual instrument that you have is only part of the picture. It's also about how it's used, and nobody could swing like Frank. I mean, the obvious example is his son, who really could sing, but didn't really, this just something intangible that he didn't have. And as good as he was, he did not swing like his father. And
right.
who knows what, and that kind of stuff, you just cannot teach it. I don't care how
especially a career like the time, the era. I mean, that he's like a time machine.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I can't imagine the force, everything behind that. I mean, I saw Tony Bennett like at Monterey, and I remember his sound check was the same. It was basically like just like a trio playing sound check, and he didn't come till 5 minutes before showtime, and he got out of a limo and he just walked on stage. And he was like an older man, like, and I remember being backstage watching him come on and stuff. And as soon as he hit the stage, he was like, you know, it was like 1950, you know, like he just had this, and he sang like, I couldn't believe it. I cried. It was ridiculous. Mm. But like, and then he got back off stage and he was like an older man again, and he got in his car and he left.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was just like that. It's the power of like an entire era. I mean, it's not even music at that point. It's like the color red, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's like an actual thing. Like, so I can't like, you know, can't even imagine being in a band like that. So that's just crazy.
I feel very fortunate. I was literally on the tail end of all that stuff.
Yeah.
But it was still there when I was on the road with Buddy Rich. There were still bands on the road. Woody Herman was out. Maynard was out.
Yep.
And we would run into each other in different cities. And we all kind of knew that this is the end. But it was still there. And when I think about, I worked with Sinatra the last 4 years he worked. Ironically, he collapsed and fell down where I live now in Richmond, Virginia in 1994. And here I am, whatever, you know, almost whatever, 25, 30 years later.
Yeah.
But it was really, at that time, I said, man, I feel so fortunate that I got some of this in before this ended, but I played his last concert.
That's something, man. I mean, not just that, but going back to his feel, he had this swing, but it was such a natural feel that worked in so many areas. Like that Joe Beam record is, mm-hmm. is one of my favorites.
And absolutely.
It's doesn't sound weird. I mean, just like Stan Getz doesn't sound weird, because he's not playing bossa rhythms. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
Stan Getz sounded like Stan Getz playing on that stuff. And Sinatra, it's just a marriage. It worked. His sound was so identifiable. It just worked cross styles, you know, interstylistically, if that's a word. But it's something about him. I don't think that a lot of people would be able to pull that off. And as much as I like Tony Bennett and people like that, Mel Torme and a lot of other great jazz singers, there's something about Frank that holds a different place in my heart.
Oh, I agree. And I think that the root of it is that he was the Charlie Parker of his genre. He pretty much invented what he did. He obviously was so influenced by Bing Crosby and,
right,
and other of that generation, but he's the one who put it together. I mean, you can almost make an analogy between how Bird was influenced by his predecessors, but he's the one who really put it together. And Sinatra obviously had a different path. He lived a long and productive life, had a hugely resilient, I mean, considering what he did to himself,
yeah,
career, and was able to reinvent himself. It seems like, well, certainly at least three different times. But it's amazing.
Yeah, and he was a movie star too, and just
and a good actor. I mean, he was great.
Yeah,
it wasn't like it was. You know, it's not anything that wasn't, when you watch
like Elvis movies or something like that.
Nothing was unnatural.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, never unnatural.
He was great in From Here to Eternity and Manchurian Candidate. And those are both, he was absolutely great.
Yeah.
And he worked. He worked really hard at it. He didn't take it for granted. It wasn't just a cameo. Nope. Yeah, it was very, very interesting cultural hero.
After the Sinatra stuff, you were living in New York. I mean, I'm sure at this time you were in New York City, right? The whole time through Buddy and through Frank. And
yeah, I moved to New York in 80 and I kind of knocked around for a few months, and then just kind of by virtue of being young and having no fear, I managed to get myself on the Buddy Rich Band. But I had moved to New York in the fall of 80 and I joined the band in 81.
After this, you're doing mainly your own stuff at that point, or
you're just doing
a lot of sideman stuff after the Frank gig?
I was basically working as a secretary after the Frank gig. I mean, I had nothing. I had zero work. I just decided that at the time I got married for the first time in 84. I just decided kind of in an arbitrary way that I needed to get off the road. I needed to figure out how to not be on the road. And I had nothing. I mean, I didn't even know how to play a club date. So
did you feel like a hard hitter though? Like you're like, I'm a fucking bop machine. Like I want to get out there and do my own thing. Like,
what was your confidence? At that time, I wasn't that confident. I knew that I wanted to, but I also knew that I really had so much to learn. And I kind of knew that I was in the right place to do it. But you've probably heard a lot of stories about people who they know enough to wait until they get to New York, until they're skilled. I had a lot of drive, but I didn't have that much skill. I didn't know how to play a show. I didn't know how to play a club date. And I really didn't, I didn't know how to make a living in music. I just had to learn. I was kind of a knucklehead and I just had to pick it up little by little. But for years, I did day jobs. Mm-hmm. And I learned, this was before personal computers. I mean, I learned how to use word processing machines, and that's what I did. And I oftentimes would work during the day and then go play a gig at night. And I remember walking home at 1:30 in the morning in a rainstorm, thinking to myself, I already have a cold. I have to get up in 6 hours and go to this office now. That was hard. But at a certain point, I had enough happening that I was able to stop doing day jobs. And that was maybe when I was, 27, something like that. Mm. At that time, I had been with Toshiko Akiyoshi's band since I was 23, but that wasn't a full-time band. Thank God I had something to do, and I had a kind of a platform to get better. And that was just a great, great thing for me because I needed it. I needed some continuing gig that I knew that I was pretty much secure in, and I could get better. You have to get better by performing and practicing, and I had that, but it wasn't quite a living.
Yeah.
But I was very thankful to have it. It wasn't really until I got the gig with Sinatra, and I guess 1990. Yeah, I guess. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Oh no, I was doing Broadway shows before that, kind of putting it together, freelancing. So it was very gradual for me. I mean, I was a late bloomer, and I did not have my head on straight when I was young. It's just a lot of luck, I think, that I was able to hang on to these gigs. And I finally got it together as far as like learning enough. When I first went and tried to play a Broadway show, I had no idea what I was doing. I just had no patience for it. I didn't want to do it. I hated it. And it took years before I realized, listen, if you want to be in music, you're going to have to do this stuff.
Yeah.
You can't just go out and be a jazz star. That just, it's not happening for you. And that's, luckily, I mean, I finally got it together, and I knew I had enough talent. I just didn't have enough, together in my head to be humble enough to do that kind of work. But I finally learned how to do commercial work on a high level.
Yeah. But I mean, and you still had the office thing to look back at, like, well, I definitely want to do that.
I said, I mean, there was a couple of years where I did, I was able to fall back on that, but at a certain point, I have to stop doing this. I'm going to have to, this is a security blanket that I can no longer, I'm going to have to put this aside.
Yeah.
So I did.
I mean, I think that's a great gradual thing. I mean, that's kind of what we try to preach, like, with our podcasts and stuff is, you know, you need perspective.
Absolutely.
You know, perspective is what gets you working harder.
And you need work ethic too.
You need work ethic and you need humility. It's not necessarily a good thing to turn your nose up at stuff. I remember when I was young and I couldn't tell. I honestly couldn't. I remember getting a call. A friend of mine, I was called. I don't think he called me directly, but his manager called. Coming to New York. And we're doing some TV show soundtrack that they were going to come to New York and do because they wanted New York musicians. And would I come and be the tenor player? And at that time, you know, I knew it was like supposed to be kind of a vintage, old-timey kind of a session. And I turned it down because I was afraid that I would get there and it wouldn't be right. And on hindsight, I shouldn't have done that.
Right.
But then on the other side of the coin, there's other occasions where I said, okay, yeah, I'll do it. And I literally went into the Broadway show Cats with a piccolo. And I mean, I had no idea, you know, the show started and I was like, fuck, man, I made a big mistake. And now I'm stuck here making an ass out of myself for 2.5 hours. And that was just obviously a bad decision. But you know, those decisions are always going to haunt you, but you learn by doing.
Where were you in your career before you got the Steely Dan gig, and how did that come about? Did you come in right after Chris Potter and Bob Shepard and those guys, or was there someone else in between?
No, that's exactly what happened.
Okay.
Because Chris was in the band really for not very long. He made that record when they came back in 2000, that won a Grammy, which is, I mean, that's absolutely great record. But then he was pretty much busy doing his own thing. And at that time, those guys did not tour. They didn't tour every year until, ironically, well, let's see, my first tour was 2003. So at that time, well, I got the call to begin to do horn section dates for their last record, Everything Must Go. And that was in 2002. And I was such a jazz head at that time. I barely even knew who they were. I mean, I knew the record Asia because that was out when I was in college. And I knew that there were three really great tenor players on the record, and I knew about the Wayne Shorter solo on Asia, and I knew about the Pete Kristolib solo on Deacon Blues, but I really didn't understand the history of the band. And so at that time, I was, holding my own, I think, playing Broadway shows and teaching. When those dates were happening, it really didn't occur to me that it was going to turn into a gig. And I, in hindsight, I kind of get now that they were checking me out, thinking about a tour the next year that actually did happen. That was their schedule. Every 3 years they would tour. And so then, I remember what happened. So in 2002, I did, a few horn section dates, and I remember being really excited, still not really kind of getting the whole thing, but at that time I was vaguely aware of the record with Chris Potter and Two Against Nature. So let me give it enough context. So I did those horn section dates. I remember, Jim Pugh was there and Tony Cadlick and Michael Lenhart. And so those were for Everything Must Go. And then I got a call to come in and do a session. And it was told to me by a manager booker that it was going to be a solo. And I was so excited. I didn't know what to expect. And then a few days later, the same person called and said it's been canceled or postponed. And at that time, I was like, whatever, easy come, easy go. I mean, things happen, and back to my life. And a few months later, the call came in again, and lo and behold, I went in, and I did it. And I was so excited. But it was, a lot of it was came very naturally to me, because they pretty much wrote it almost around, they knew what they wanted. It was like they kind of wanted this Coltrane-esque, rubato-ish thing. And basically it took me, like a take to get that part down. But then there was a solo, which I had no idea what to do with. And I literally did it 50 times. And the changes were, they weren't jazz changes. They were like pop changes. And I didn't know how to deal with it. So we worked on it for like 3 hours. And I remember during the session, they were both very, very nice to me. And they actually got a kick out of it that I didn't seem, I think I asked them, like, is this for a label? And, so, and they were, they instead of being offended at all, they were like amused that I didn't even know kind of who they were altogether. And so the session ended, and I knew that I didn't get it. And I figured, this is going to be like one of those things that doesn't work out. And then I went and played my show that night. And I don't know why I was doing this. I hardly ever would check my machine during intermission, but I did. And there was a message from, I think it was the engineer at the studio. And he said, can you come in again tomorrow? And I called right back and said, absolutely. So I went back, and there we were again. And I just thought it was so kind of like random. I mean, how do these guys even know that I'm not going to be somewhere else tomorrow? Or, I mean, would they have rescheduled it the next week or the next month? I was just so grateful that I was able to go in again the next day. And by that time, I kind of had sat with it for 24 hours, and I knew that I didn't do well. And somehow they got enough down and they pieced together a solo, which I really, it's not that great. I mean, it's just kind of pieced together. There's three different pieces on the solo, but they seemed to like it. Okay. And that was that. And then I didn't hear anything until I think 6 months later. And I got a call from Walter Becker, and he said, do you want to do some gigs? I said, yeah, I want to do some gigs. So then it was another several months before I heard from anybody. And we toured in 2003. And I felt exactly the way I felt when I first joined the Buddy Rich Band. I just didn't have any context, didn't understand what it was. But what I thought was so interesting is that when I played with the Toshi Akiyoshi band, I realized that I was being given an opportunity. They weren't going to just fire me, that they were going to allow me to grow into the position. And I realized that, I don't think I realized this in 2003, but on hindsight, I realized that Donald and Walter were patient and they wanted jazz musicians who could function in a section. And there's not, believe it or not, there's not like a whole huge quantity of people like that. A lot of jazz players don't, for whatever reason, have the experience that some of us had playing in big bands and having to subordinate and play in a section, which is 90% of the gig with Steely Dan, but you did have to step out and play, and that's what they wanted. So when I hear clips of me playing in 2003 with those guys, I cringe because I just didn't get it. I was playing way too much, way too many notes. And I learned in big venues, all anybody hears in the audience is, yeah. I mean, this, you can't hear anything when you play more than a couple notes at a time. It's just not enough fidelity.
Right.
Oh. So I learned gradually. Well, after that, 2003, I didn't hear a thing, you know, and then we didn't tour till 2006. And I figured, because at that point I knew a little bit about their history, that they're not likely to call me back. That's what they do. They put a band together and then people go their separate ways. And then in 2005, I got this call to go on and work for Donald. And I was so excited. I couldn't believe it. I figured that, you know, that part of my life is over and done with. That's gone. And all of a sudden, I was working on Donald's solo record. And I got to play a couple of short solos on that record. And that was a thrill. That was a blast. And then we ended up touring in 2006. And then every year since then, of course, until this year when the tour was canceled, there's been some kind of a tour, which it's kind of been my, you know, my professional life since 2006. In addition to, of course, for years I maintained a teaching career in a fashion, never full time, but I was always able to juggle other stuff and was making my own records. But I feel very, very indebted to those guys. That's, believe it or not, that's the job that I've held longest of any job I ever had.
Right.
So hopefully it'll come back. You know, I wouldn't place any bets about when. I mean, these large venues, tours like that depend on thousands of people being in the same place.
Yeah.
I don't know when that's going to be able to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I did some of the opening gigs with you guys with Sam's right. band and
yeah.
like places like Ravinia, there's like what, like 15,000 people out there or something like
right.
that.
Right.
You can't do that.
Not now.
Even though it's outdoors, you still can't do that.
No, of course. I don't know when that may happen. If it does happen, it may be a while.
Yeah.
So, I guess we'll see. But yeah, that's how you and I met when you were playing with Sam. We actually played together because I remember Michael and I played some.
That was right before I did it.
Okay. Yeah,
and then.
Yeah.
And then
Michael and I played with Sam on a few of those.
I think Walter put the kibosh on that.
Yes. Yeah, it's a shame. He got jealous. We were having too much fun. But yeah, that was great too.
God rest his soul.
Yeah, man. I owe so much to Walter.
Yeah. But so in terms of what you're seeing now, so I'm assuming, I know we talked a little off of the podcast or we messaged and you said that you had a big tour canceled in January or something like that. And
yeah, my European tour. Was that yours, or was Steely Dan? It was my tour. I've been touring with terrific musicians in Europe. They're two of them are Danish, and our bass player is German, but he went to school in Denmark and now he's back living in Berlin. So we've been working together now. This would have been the first tour I did 4 years ago was with a different bass player, Daniel Frank, who's also a terrific player. The past 3 years has been the band we worked with since, Anders Morgensen and Carl Winter and Andreas Lang as the bassist.
Oh, cool.
Who's terrific also, but we have had the same season, mid-January through mid-February, 4 years running, made three recordings, and we're going to do it again. But I think, I hate to say it, we all kind of knew what was going to happen, that nobody wanted to be the one to say it, but the whole tour was booked as of, you know, a month ago. But
yeah,
it was like a slow train, you know, you can't stop it. Right. We just knew this was coming, and I didn't want to be the one to say we're going to have to cancel, and they didn't want to be the ones to say we're going to cancel, but we're going to have to cancel.
Yeah.
So the irony is, I think that a tour like that will be able to happen in 2022 because they're small venues and doesn't depend on 10,000 people being in the same place. So I am very optimistic long-term about that. But yeah, that's what's happening. So, or not happening, I should say.
And you're teaching at a university at this point?
No. No, I'm not teaching at a university. No, I wanted to stop when I moved to Virginia. Mm-hmm. That was my premise. I just wanted to put that behind me. And I, not that I'm not involved in education, of course, you know that I am because I'm working for you doing these videos. That's how I feel that...
you want to do it on your terms, though?
I want to do what I, you know, when I want to do it. I don't want to be... when I first moved down here, I was still giving occasional lessons on Skype. And at a certain point, I just realized I just need the time to practice. I want to do all this stuff, but I don't have the time to do it. And I'm not a workaholic. I need some flexibility. And this, I've been telling myself, I would tell myself for years, why can't someone like me play some of these tunes in 12 keys like I'm preaching? I would tell myself this, there's certain things I should be able to do, and I can't do them because I need the time to be able to do it. So now I have it, and I have no more excuses, particularly now since there's no gigs to play and nowhere to go. So damn. I kind of make myself practice an hour a day, and I've really gotten a lot done. I feel very good about it. I feel in a lot of ways I'm all dressed up with no place to go because I don't have any gigs. But believe me, when it's time, I'll be ready because yeah. I don't practice a whole lot, but I practice a good hour a day.
Right. But you have a plan. It's not just...
Exactly.
You know exactly what you're working on. And that, you know, an hour could be worth more than four if you do it right.
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, I definitely do. In my teaching, I've said that when you sit down to practice, try just to start playing. Have something you're working on. Don't think too much about what am I going to do. Just start your project. And I'm able to take my own advice because I could go down the black hole of, am I practicing the right thing? Should I practice? Should I move on to a different tune? But sometimes I tell myself, don't think, just play the routine. And that's half the battle, is just getting through your routine. At this point, my routine is get the horn out, put a reed on, and play Hot House in 12 keys, which I have been telling myself I should be able to do, but it was a huge project for me. It took me months and months to you know, learn the head, learn it correctly. And then because my ears weren't really good enough to transpose the head and by ear, I had to write it down. And I made myself just, I said, don't agonize. You know, you're not a bad person. Just transpose it on the computer and write it out and learn it. So that's what I did. So I'm still doing that. So at a certain point, I, you know, once in a while, I'll mix in another head. I have maybe a dozen or so heads that I play in 12 keys, and then I play a few choruses. And then I move on to my new toys, which is, you know, I finally got a condenser mic and an interface, and now I'm starting to, I think I'm just going to record my own record from here. And
do it.
I am. I mean, I can't bear the thought of, I was all excited and prepared to record with my guys in January, but that's not going to happen. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to prepare these tracks. I'm going to learn how to use the software. And I'm going to send everything over to them and have them record their parts, and then we're going to release it. So that's my long-term plan. Yeah, I mean, it's going to have to.
So for those of you who don't know, Walt has done some super cool videos with us. He did this series that he's still working on. And the first one, which was released a bit ago, was called Standards GPS, Getting Past the Surface, Stella. So that's all about, you know, getting under the hood of Stella by Starlight and really understanding it and being able to play through it. And the new one that will be released tomorrow or Monday, just check the site, will be All the Things You Are. So same thing, Standards GPS, All the Things You Are. I think it's called All the Things. And I think that you should do Hot House next, Walt. I think that would be the right one.
Well, I guess, yeah, there's so many candidates, but I'm really excited about it. And I got to really take my hat off to you, Adam. You're the one who wrote to me last year and said, why don't you do something from your, you know, do it yourself. And at that point, I said, well, there's no way I'm doing that. Because in the past, we have met at a studio in New York City, and in a few hours, we'd put it down. But then I said, well, I got nothing else to do, so I might as well think about this. And I just kind of figured it out little by little. It's actually been really gratifying, because I realized that, unlike when we're in the studio and I feel the pressure of the clock, I can just keep doing this and doing it until I get it right.
Yep.
So that's given me, in a way, a lot of freedom, and I really like it. And I also realized that for each one of these that I've done, and of course there'll be more, this is all stuff that I never really took the time to understand in the way that it should or needs to be understood. And that's the whole idea of getting past the surface. And instead of approaching a tune like that, playing the same stuff I always play, well, I guess there's always going to be that. The idea is to raise the level of the same stuff I always play, to really try and understand what harmonically is working in a less than surfacey way that's been natural. It's just, there's so much stuff to cover. It's natural for people. Once you can get through something, you kind of figure, okay, I got, you know, I can get through that. Okay. Even if it's surfacey, I'm going to fool most of the people most of the time. But the reality is, you're not really getting underneath the hood, like you said. Very well said. So anyway, that's the concept, and I really like it. So I definitely have thought about, what is this thing called Love Changes, which is where Hot House comes from. So
that'll do
it. Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's
one I've heard a few times before.
Yeah, certainly these tunes. That's a good example. I mean, they're played a million times, but it's really hard.
Yeah, except that Hot House's melody is just a lot harder.
Oh my God!
Yeah, because what is this thing called love? Is very, it's lucid and melodic, and it makes it, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the Hot House head.
Yeah.
Is nuts.
Yeah.
But I mean, that in itself is a whole lesson.
Yeah, that's like an etude that was written basically.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But, you know, it's been great catching up with you, man. Is there anything that you want anyone to know about before we sign off, or just that, you know, you're giving your best?
I'm trying. I mean, we're all trying to get through this. And I'm actually, when you think about the old adage that necessity is a mother of invention, I am really excited about these new things that I'm doing and would not have done if it weren't for this insanity that we're going through. Yeah. But it never would have occurred to me to make a video for you from my attic.
Or record.
Or record. It never would have occurred to me to get this. Oh, it's just happening. I was talking to my old buddy Mike Smith, who I mentioned earlier was the reason that we all were working with Frank Sinatra in 1990. And he's had the whole studio thing, like you guys, together for years. And I just avoided it basically until last week.
Right.
And after I talked to him, I said the same thing I always say. I said, well, then it's going to take time away from my practice. And I know that it's going to be a time suck, which it is.
Yeah.
But after I got off the phone, I just, all of a sudden, I had like a gestalt switch. I just said, you know what? I'm doing this. I'm doing it right now. And I ordered the stuff and I have it. And I'm going to start taking lessons and figure it out. And other people do it. So why can't I do it? And I'm already so excited about stuff that I'm able to do here that in a way I would never be able to do if it were kind of the old days. You know, now I feel like I have all this control, which is very interesting. So you adapt. I mean, humans can adapt.
And once you get the hang of the basics, it won't be such a time suck. Like, eventually you can set your rig up so that your mic is plugged in and everything is good. It's on the level you want it to be. And then you can just press record on the software and put your idea down quickly and efficiently.
Yeah, I can see it happening. I can see it. I know I've done, when I first used notation software, it took me forever to write a page, and I knew it would.
Yeah, I feel like notation software is just as difficult. You know what I mean? It's not.
Yeah,
it's not easier.
I'm awful at it.
Yeah, it's
I'm
hard.
Trying to get better with that.
Yeah, that stuff is tough.
Yeah, but it's really helped me out. I'm actually interested that it's not universal among young people to use notation software. They're more likely to be able to use recording software like this stuff, but I mean, notation software just as important to me.
Of course it is. Yeah. I mean, especially if you have a band that needs to read something. I mean,
yeah,
quickly and legibly.
Right. Yeah, that's a pet peeve of mine. The more legible something is, the better performance you're going to get, and you're going to save a lot of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like one of those back to the beginning spots, but those Broadway charts are such a fucking mess. Like, you have, you know, someone's notes on top of someone's notes, and you know that when they write, oh, do you remember those?
Absolutely. Like, yeah. if you're coming into that cold, you don't stand a chance. No. And that's always been a pet peeve. I mean, I know I have a little bit of OCD, but my friends in everywhere will tell you, I mean, I literally bring masking tape to Europe because I know these guys are going to print out the pages and not tape them together. And it drives me absolutely crazy. And I'll sit there and make them, listen, you guys, here's the tape. I'm not going to play a gig and have pages falling. Not doing it. You might want to do that.
Yeah.
And when we would give an occasional clinic, I'd go through the same routine with the students because the same thing will happen.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Masking tape. Yeah, man. U.S. masking tape. Bring it around the world.
You can't count on being able to find it over there. No. You know, you can't even find aspirin over there sometimes.
You can find heroin
in Amsterdam, but you can't find a Tylenol.
Pretty much.
Or ice.
Exactly. Yeah, you'd have to go to a painting shop or something. And, you know, I don't know how to say that in Dutch. So.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, thanks, man. It was great catching up.
Oh, it's been
up.
Great. And, thank you so much, Adam.
Have a good weekend.
And Jake, thank you.
Yeah.
We'll get all this stuff out soon.
Yeah, and thank you guys for all the work on the videos. I really appreciate it. I'm so excited about it.
Right on, man.
Keep them coming. I love the tune by tune thing. That's my favorite.
Oh, I'm so glad.
All right, man. Talk soon.
All right. See you soon.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail. You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So, look forward to hearing from you.